Welcome to Trib Talk Live, a series of public events designed to educate and engage. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce of the Salt Lake Tribune, the sponsor of tonight's forum, What Happened on the Hill, recapping the 2015 Utah legislative session. We're broadcasting live from the City Library in downtown Salt Lake City on KCPW 88.3 and 105.3 FM. Those in our live audience will have a chance to ask questions later in the program. But first, analysis from our distinguished panel. House Speaker Greg Hughes, Republican from Draper, is here. Speaker Hughes, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, House Minority Whip Rebecca Chavez-Houck is with us. She's a Democrat from Salt Lake City.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Senate Minority Caucus Manager Jim DeBacchus, a Democrat of Salt Lake City, is also with us.
Hi, Jennifer.
And freshman Senator Ann Milner, Republican of Davis County, former Weber State University president. And Senator, welcome to you.
Thank you very much for having me join you.
And we welcome you all and our moderator, Tribune senior political reporter, Robert Gerke. Welcome.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Thank you. So we're going to try to move this along pretty fast. We're going to try to jump from cover several issues. Of course, the big issue that we wanted to cover right out of the gate is the Medicaid expansion, Healthy Utah. We saw a lot of talk back and forth, a lot of noise, but in the end, we ended up not seeing anything done. I'm going to start with Representative Chavez-Houck. Can you explain to us, in the last days of the session, you made a motion to have Healthy Utah considered on the House floor. Can you explain to us why you thought that was the best option at that point?
Well, you know, we Democrats, during the session, a lot of what we were trying to present to the public was a face of being the ears for the state. We were listening and we heard a lot within the broader community of how people wanted to have a vote on the floor for Healthy Utah. I know the speaker will speak to the direction that we went and the journey that that particular piece of legislation went, as well as Utah Cares. But throughout the session, we were hearing people say that they really wanted to have it discussed, not just by a committee, but to take it to the full House and to respond to the work that had been done for the last two, almost 3 years on this issue. We've had numerous study groups. I know that I served on the governor's Medicaid Working Group in 2013 and had a number of people that are involved in that. We came away with seven recommendations that were presented last year. Then last year, the governor worked very diligently with the federal HHS to see what kind of negotiation could occur, what kind of consensus or compromise, what I like to call the Utah Compromise, could come forth. And he walked away with 13 of the 14 asks that he had presented to the president and to the HHS, the federal HHS department. And we were hearing from colleagues who were hearing from their constituents that they wanted a vote. And we wanted to be able to have that dialogue. We wanted to be able to have a public conversation about it and to afford those who were hearing from their constituents an opportunity then for them to cast either a or a nay on Healthy Utah. So we made that attempt, and graciously the speaker afforded us that opportunity to have that dialogue. And I think it presented a richer discussion as we entered the final discussion into Utah Cares. And there are people from both sides of the aisle that are now looking at that vote on my substitute as a way that they can go back to their constituents and say, this is what the vote on Healthy Utah looked like. Yeah. So that was that attempt.
You got some finality, at least.
Yeah.
You got a count.
At that point,
where the. So, Speaker Hughes, the governor's pitch for Healthy Utah was it would cover 126,000 people, cost about $25 million over the 2 years, draw down about $1 billion in federal fund over the 2 years. The counteroffer that came from the House was Utah Cares, which covers about 50 to 60,000 people, and is going to cost more money over the period of time, bring down less federal money. So explain to our listeners in the audience why you guys didn't want to see Healthy Utah get through, and what your concerns were about it.
You know, one of the things I want to point out, though, is that, and we struggled on how to communicate this effectively. Right now, if you're making 100% of federal poverty or more, mm-hmm. there is a plan. There is health care provided. Medicaid is available for all all those Utahns who'd like that want to sign up. And the federal government runs all of it and pays for all of it. So when we talk about what Healthy Utah covered by way of citizens, it went into that pool of people that are currently already covered by Medicaid that the federal government administers. So when you compare Utah Cares or what the House's response was, the number was less, but if you went to the people that were up to 138% who were already covered, we think that that captured as many Utahns. And the fact of the matter is this, 0 to 100% of federal poverty are who have been left out after the Supreme Court decision. What we looked at in the House was a scenario where in our conference calls with Washington, D.C. and Health and Human Services, they did not consider dealing with and providing health care for those at 0 to 100% of poverty, the ACA, which came with a 90% federal match. They said that's a traditional Medicaid waiver that you're asking for, and so it's going to cost more because it's the 70% match versus 30. However, this is the big difference. We felt in the House far more comfortable, and people need to appreciate that when we started this discussion, the largest pool of House members would prefer a wait-and-see mode versus doing anything. We want to provide health care coverage for those that don't have it, but we wanted to go within that 0 to 100% because we didn't think that was we thought that was sustainable. And it cost more, but it was sustainable, and it was a place where we were willing to go. We couldn't get, there was a barrier there. We weren't able to get that agreement. But I thought the House moved greatly from where we had started this debate to where we had ended in terms of trying to provide coverage for those that didn't have it. We were able to provide it 0 to 100%. But look, it's one of the shortest legislative sessions in this country. And it's a generational decision. It's not one that we'll come back and make on an annual basis. We've got to get it right. And I think the way to get it right is to have these concerns addressed even beyond this general session. And I think that's what you saw in our resolution, is that we are resolved, the governor, myself, the Senate president, the sponsors, the House and Senate sponsors of the bill, Representative Dunnigan, Senator Shuizawa, to continue to work forward to get this issue done the right way.
Senator Backus, you care to rebut that?
I am so proud of the Senate. The Senate got it right. Look, this is supposed to be this unbelievably complex, difficult, horrible decision. It's simple. It's not hard. Utah pays taxes to Washington, and the federal government in 2021 has a check for $747,700,000 a year. This is money we've already paid to Washington. The check comes, it arrives, the governor opens it. And the legislature says, no, we just don't know. We don't want to take the money. This provides health care for our poorest citizens. More than a quarter of our state budget comes from the federal government now in Washington. Transportation dollars, water projects, every kind of thing you can imagine. But here's where we draw the line. We don't want those federal dollars for those poor Utah citizens to get health care. That's where we draw the line. Send it back to Washington. This was not brain science. This was a slam dunk, easy, go for it decision. We should have taken that money. Last year, we sent back a check for $354 million. This year, it's going to be even more. We're dinking around. So now what do? We voted by resolution to set up a committee that's going to solve all this. Who is this? It's the same cast of characters that have been studying it for 22 months. The governor, the lieutenant governor, the speaker, who I adore, the president of the Senate, and two other Republicans. So the six Republican, none of them poor, all of them make $100,000 a year or more, who haven't been able to settle it all along, are going to sit down and they're going to tell the poor people in our state, you know, we're going to send back a bunch of this federal money out of principle. Give me a break.
So, Senator Milner, try not to upstage Jim here, but you were one of the Republicans in the Senate who voted for this bill, and the Senate passed the Healthy Utah bill out. Looking ahead, are you optimistic that we're going to be able to come to some resolution, or is this chasm between the House and the Senate, or between Utah Cares and Healthy Utah, too wide at this point?
You know, I'm a freshman, so I probably look at things with freshman eyes, and I'm still learning about the process. But one of the things that I sat next to Senator Shiozawa on the Senate floor, and so I was able to actually have the opportunity to discuss this issue often with him as we went along in the process. And I think what he was really looking for was to engage and have more dialogue earlier during the session. It wasn't until the end of the session that people really started to engage and said, we probably need to come together and get all the parties at the table and talk about what our options are and try to find a way forward. And the Senate really felt like in terms of looking at this, and much like Senator DeBacchus said, being able to serve more people at actually for the next 2 years at a lower cost to the state of Utah, return more money here, serve more people, do it as a pilot project. Because one of the issues out there is, what are the unknowns? People are very concerned about do we have the numbers right? Are our estimates correct? I mean, I do think from the House perspective, but also from a number of senators as well, that concern about this feels like unknown territory for us, and we are fiscally conservative in this state, and we do like to be able to make sure that we can pay for programs that we launch. Really understanding that and moving to that pilot program, I think, was a way for people to say, here's a strategy for us to be able to learn, to make sure people really do understand it's a pilot, be able to provide this service and access to health care for Utahns during this period of time, but to limit the kind of potential financial risk, because nobody knows. I mean, we don't know if it is or it is not. So I'm hopeful that all the parties are going to be able to come together to be able to find a place that will fit for Utah and be the right solution for Utah. And I know that those are going to be, you know, healthy discussions. And the complexity of this is that it's not just a Utah decision. It really involves the federal government through the waiver process, and anything that we try to structure for this state, we have, you know, another player in this that requires waivers oftentimes, et cetera. So finding our way through this in a way that works for Utah, but we get the federal go-ahead, I think is challenging at best.
You're going to be one of the people discussing this with the governor and with the Senate president and others. If we're sitting in a situation where you guys can go up to 100%, the governor can't come down to 138%. There seems to be this divide here, and you've said before, it takes three to tango. It takes the House, the Senate, and the governor. But as Senator Milner pointed out, you've got this fourth dance partner, this sort of this Frankenstein that moves in a sort of lumbering,
terrible,
slow fashion.
Yes,
so how do you end up where? Just you don't want to prejudge the negotiations, but how do we break this?
There isn't a check that comes back to the state of Utah. There are healthcare providers that would receive these federal funds. It's not money that comes back to the state coffers. We only pay out. So we get money, we have to balance the budget, whatever we receive. So this year, the consensus numbers was the Medicaid programs that we provide today, they were $22 million short. $11 million ongoing, $11 million one time. We went into the social services budgets, and I wish you could see what we have to cut so that we can fund the growth in Medicaid as it is today. So when we talk about going over the 100% poor, another word for 100% poor are the poor. When you now ask the state of Utah, whatever that match be, 10% at 90% match or 30% at a 70% match, we only know as appropriators the money that we have to spend out there. So my question is this, it's that over the poor, when you're talking about more than 0 to 100% where we had the big rub, who's going to pay that amount if we're wrong? We had the hospital say, look, charge hospital fees. We'll cover the amount that's going to be that 100 to 138, and we'll cover it. And the question was, what if the populations are more than we've projected, or the costs are higher? Will you pay that too? Absolutely not. Well, we have to balance our budgets. At what point of our state budget, more health and human services costs, or public ed, higher ed, where are we going to come up with that difference? If someone can show me where we are willing to take those dollars out of a balanced budget, then I think you've got a deal. But that question is, well, we don't know, and we'll just take it away in 2 years if it doesn't work out. Well, I'll tell you, we yo-yoed Medicaid, dental, and vision. In the best of years, we provided it, and I watched in the worst of years pulling it away, and it's a much smaller population and a much smaller program. My takeaway from that as a lawmaker was, you better be in for the long haul if you're going to do this. I know everyone says, we're fine having it only for 2 years. I will tell you, I can't find an advocate that with a straight face says, I'll fight to take this away if it's not there. And I haven't found anyone in the minority party saying, if in 2 years we can't afford it, we're all in on getting rid of it. That's easy to say today, but I will tell you, show me how, if the numbers are wrong. And by the way, last year's actuarial numbers were half of what this year's estimates came in at. Last year we were told if we made this decision, this generational decision, it was going to be $40 million ongoing. That number is now $78 million at 90%, and it's even worse when you talk about that 0 to 100%. The ground keeps shifting underneath us, and we have to know, on the long view, how are we going to keep our promises to Utahns, and how are we going to make sure this is a long... The House is in for the long haul, Robert. We are not looking... A pilot, for me, in education, is a small, limited amount of people that we take this policy and test it and get data from it. This pilot we're talking about in Medicaid is... to scale. It is statewide. It is everyone. That's not a pilot as policymakers have talked about pilots before. So tell me how you're going to how we're going to do this long term. And I've not been happy, and the House hasn't been happy with the King's X provision of, if it doesn't work and it doesn't make sense and we don't have the money, we'll just stop doing it.
Representative Chavez Houck, and then we're going to move to another issue.
To this discussion. Number one, over the last 2 years, we've overestimated our enrollment on Medicaid, and have had the opportunity to pull back funds that we thought we weren't going to have to expend on Medicaid and pull them back into the general fund, and we've used them for various uses, much to my chagrin. But we've had that overage because we've overestimated. And that's one of my concerns with some of the actuarial numbers that Milliman provided is they are estimates, but what I can look at is I can look at what's happened in states that have already done the expansion. If we look at Arkansas, for example, and we look at the reduction in how many people who were previously uninsured and now currently are uninsured, it's dropped almost by double. They had 22% uninsured in Arkansas in 2013. This year, it's closer to 11% in terms of those that are uninsured. And what they're finding across the U.S. is those states that have an exchange that's similar to ours, which is federal, but yes, we also have our Avenue H for our businesses, for SHOP, that when they've done, the states that have done that, in addition to Medicaid expansion, have had the biggest drop in the number of uninsured. And what you see with that is people returning to work, they come back into the workforce, they're oftentimes off of additional federally subsidized programs like TANF and food stamps and other things like that. So we've had this discussion of the projection with the woodwork and the crowd out, but what you've seen in some of these states that have moved forward progressively and have captured all of this, as they've been able to offset it, they've been able to take the funds that they save and they put it in a reserve, which is something that I've always argued. We take what we save from this, we put it into what we are going to have to pay in 2021.
15 right. Seconds.
Okay. To Rebecca's point, we got on a conference call with Health and Human Services and said this very thing, check our math. Check the actuarial reports we've done to make sure we're not cooking the books. But can we budget to the population we project? Answer, no. Can we budget to the dollars that we think it will cost so that we make sure that we can afford it? Answer has been no. So when you talk about a dance partner that, you know, with two left feet, you have had us stabbing out there trying to find some certainty in this space, saying, let us cap to the population or to the cost, something that we know that we can pay the bills. The answer back has always been no, and that doesn't leave us with the certainty, because what Rebecca says is true. Maybe these are over forecasts. We just want to be able to budget to what we have forecast.
You want to be able to put a lid on it, either population or cost. Okay. I want to talk to, we're going to move on to another topic. I'm sorry. We got to keep this moving.
The filibuster from the House.
I was going to say, we didn't get our
We could spend a full hour on this one.
We're senators. We can.
So here behind us, we have a picture of the historic news conference where the LDS General Authorities came for the announcement of this this new bill, this new way, this new path forward, as you called it, I think, where we are balancing the religious freedoms element with anti-discrimination for LGBT community in employment and housing. Can you talk a little bit about, you've been involved in this since 2008, 2007, in meetings with the church and discussions and leading up to the Salt Lake Ordinance. Talk to us a little bit about your feelings as this thing came together.
I'm headed to the Middle East.
Because you're going to...
I think it'll be easy.
You're going to bring them all together, huh?
Look, I'm terrifically proud of our legislature, even the House. Speaker Hughes, I am proud of the Senate. I am proud of the religious leaders in this community, not just the LDS, but Bishop Wester from the Catholic Church and Bishop Hayashi. And the LDS, there was a moment in the discussions where it had gone south, and we just couldn't get over it. We just couldn't get past what we needed to get past. And there's 100 lawyers. There's nothing worse than that, you know, having all those lawyers everywhere, and that, you know, our lawyers who I love, and the other lawyers, and you know, they're just talking blah blah, and the bigger vision of where the state needs to go. Which is no discrimination. We're Utah. You know, we're not Alabama. We just are not there. We don't believe that. It's not in our core values. It's just not. And also religious liberty. It's incredibly important. And I think through this torturous system, I hope what happened is we set the Utah example of, you know, the speaker and I disagree on almost everything. But
really? Let's explore that a little bit.
But I love Greg, and I love working with him, and I love the fire of being able to go and just say, Greg, you're so crazy on this or that, and taking it back. You know, he's a boxer, and that's the Utah way, kind of. We spar, but our basic core values, religious liberty and non-discrimination, and we were able to pull it off.
Let me ask you fundamentally, is this going to have a practical impact on day-to-day lives of gay and lesbian Utahns or people of faith in Utah?
I think it absolutely is. This would prohibit, for example, a religious person who, after work, participates in some kind of a... I can't imagine this happening, but let's suppose that they go to the 24th of July parade, and they're working for somebody that doesn't like LDS people, and they start talking about that, or their picture is in the paper. You can no longer be fired for that. You're protected. That there is serious religious liberties issues that we needed to make sure, or maybe a more concrete issue. After Prop 8, apparently people that supported Prop 8 publicly were fired. And the First Amendment guarantees that that shouldn't happen. And I think this protects that, and it says in no uncertain terms, you as an employer cannot fire somebody because they're LGBT, and you must not discriminate in housing. Those are there, they're strong, they've got teeth, and it puts Utah on the map.
Speaker, over in the House, I guess you weren't involved in the day-to-day negotiations, but you were monitoring this as it goes. You've talked a little bit about your approach to this issue. Can you kind of explain how you personally approach this issue? And
so one of my frustrations over the years, as we have talked about anti-discrimination and religious liberty, is they're just silos, as if they were mutually exclusive. What I was excited about when the LDS Church came out with their statement is finally we began speaking about how we treat each other with respect and dignity, whether it's the church that you attend on Sunday or whether it's the makeup of your household, we're going to treat each other the way we'd like to be treated. And that was such a great way to start our session in terms of our goal of how we could arrive at legislation that gets to that way of thinking. And I thought that Jim and Senator Adams, they did an incredible job. Over in the House, we have some people, Representative Christensen, who has been in this space. He was the sponsor of the constitutional amendment. We knew we had people, policymakers in the House, who would have a role in this debate one way or the other, good or bad. And we worked very hard in the House. If you'll notice, Representative Christensen was the sponsor of one of the bills. And you know what, there was a compromise and an acceptance of the good work that Senator Adams and Senator Urquhart and Senator DeBacchus had done. And we sent that bill through, we passed it through without any amendments. And you'll see with pretty much very little even debate in opposition. I thought that that was important for this debate to come through the House and have that kind of support. And we in the House had to be ready for that. And we had to accept what was coming over and work and again coalesce. It was a heavy lift over on our side just for that side of it. But it recognized the important work that had been done. And I think it's, again, a model for this country.
Representative Chavez-Houck, did this go far enough?
You know, I've been talking to a lot of my constituents from the LGBT community and wanted to get from them where they wanted me to be on this. And I listened to them and they said, this is something, you know, it gets us in a safe place in terms of accommodations to a certain level related to employment. But you know, to be candid, I think about the young LGBT person that works for Deseret Book that hasn't come out yet and what that looks like for him or her. I look at
because just to be clear, it exempts religious organizations, religious businesses, and
affiliates.
Yeah.
And I think about the fact when I think about employers of 15 or less, how much do they make up of the people that run our daily businesses and our work lives? So, personally, I would have liked to have seen it gone farther, but as a step. And in any civil rights fight, we are a series of steps. It's always a journey. And for the people that can sleep more comfortably at night, knowing that they are living in, you know, they can apply to rent an apartment and know that they're not going to be turned away. And for those that are in larger companies that feel safe and more comfortable, then that gives me comfort. But I still think we've got a long ways to go. I look forward to the day when we look at this as a national issue, as having been reconciled, so we don't even have to look at it as a state issue anymore.
Okay. Senator Milner, I wanted to come to you on a different topic, if we could. You were chair of the Education Committee this year in your first session.
Yes.
There's been a lot made of the roughly $500 million that was allocated to education this year, both public and higher education. Are you pleased with what you were able to do there? And kind of, can you tell us a little bit in broad terms about what you think was accomplished on the education front this session?
Well, what might be helpful, first of all, is to kind of establish, I was chair of the Education Standing Committee looks at the bills. Senator Stevenson is chair of the Higher Education, of the Public Education Appropriations Committee, and Senator Urquhart is chair of the Higher Ed Appropriations Committee. So a lot of the work on appropriations actually gets done through those committees. What I will say is that this is a substantially better year for education than we have had for a number of years. The governor kind of set a high bar out there when he did his kind of WPU at 6.25%. And as we all know, in Utah, we're going to balance our budget and we're going to do it in fiscally prudent ways and be careful about that. But I think there were several things that happened. One is that we were able to fully fund growth. We were able to get a 4% in the WPU. And we were also able to deal with a tax equalization issue that had been kind of an issue for several years. And kind of watching the debate over how do we kind of deal with the equalization of our educational funds across the state on the property tax side. We've done a pretty good job of doing that on the income tax side, and in fact, we're known across the country for that, but we're not known across the country for what we're doing on the property tax side. In Arizona and some other states have had, you know, court cases on those things, and the courts have come in and had to settle that. In Utah, we try to be proactive, and I think through a number of iterations, we were able to kind of get there this year. And so that actually provides some additional funding as well. So I think public education probably had a substantially better year than they have had in almost the last decade, at least since the Great Recession. I do believe that higher education probably is feeling the kind of that they didn't receive the same kind of funding this year that they would like to have received. They didn't receive the same kind of compensation increase. It was 2% versus 3% that other state workers received. They didn't receive as much funding. They received funding on the kind of research and graduate program side and the performance-based funding side, but not for some of their other mission-based areas. But they also did receive some funding in engineering for the engineering initiative. So I think there's, people would say, there was substantially more support for public education than we've seen in a long time. I talked to a couple of superintendents in the last couple of days who are really grateful for the support that they've received. And they are grateful that the legislature was willing to be strong and bold in this session and really support public education.
Can you talk to us a little bit about, you sponsored a bill to have partisan school board elections, and that was a big fight back and forth between the House and Senate, ultimately on the last night. You weren't able to come to an agreement on it. Can you talk to us a little bit about how that one transpired and why you think it's important that we have these partisan elections in these, for these school board races?
Well, actually, I mean, there for me, there's three conversations going on. One is, do we elect, and if we are elect, do we do that from partisan races or nonpartisan races? But there's also a question about, should we consider an appointment process? I come from higher education, and I've worked with the Board of Regents. I mean, I've been in Utah for 33 years, and the Board of Regents has been functioning since I've been a part of the USHE system. And one of the things that I've seen is that it's an appointed board. It actually links together the governor, the legislature, because there's confirmation by the Senate in the appointment of the individuals that serve on that board. And then you have connected to that appointed board. And as a result of that, I watched the conversations that happen at a big picture level. And I think those conversations are really important. And they tend to then kind of establish big picture issues, but then allow the institutions kind of set up accountability measures. We talked about performance-based funding a lot in this session and trying to establish metrics for that. But then allow the institutions to manage to those metrics, but do it in their way, their own way. And it's going to be very different at the University of Utah than it's going to be at Snow College. Well, let's take that scenario and think about it on the public education side. If we could link the governor, who right now talks a lot about education but has no authority really in education, the legislature funds education and we consider lots of bills in education, but if we could link the governor and the legislature and a state school board together, and again, we could focus, I mean, my vision of this, we have focused on accountability measures and performance measures, and then we try to return to local control with our school districts. And we expect them to perform, we expect them to measure their performance, that we establish real consequences for that. But for me, Senate District 18, there are four school districts that kind of are part of Senate District 18 or that Senate District 18 overlaps. Morgan District, which is a rural district, very different than a Davis School District, which is the second largest in the state, or an Ogden District, which is one of the most diverse school districts in the state, versus a Weber District, which is probably the only kind of somewhat typical. So for me, I'd like to get the dialogue going about all the options and think about what will best position us for the future. And this would have to be a vote of the people. But let's let the people decide. Let's let the people, let's weigh the merits of the arguments. Let's talk about what the future looks like. And then, because it has to be a constitutional amendment, let's let the people decide what they think is going to best serve governance in public education going forward.
Do any of you have any thoughts on education funding or the school board issue in general?
Let me just say, we tried. We had a conference committee report. What happened was the bill came over. We didn't accept the Senate amendments. We asked them to recede. They refused. You set a conference committee. That conference committee, and last night, we as a caucus got together to say, look, this is what we can get. If we don't do anything, we'll let a judge potentially decide how school board members are elected. We need to get this right. There is a rub between those that would see a partisan election and a nonpartisan election, because even if you'd like to get to that ballot question to change the Constitution to let the governor choose like a Board of Regents, you still have school board members that are up for re-election that same year. So right. You had to have at least a temporary election process in place. It comes down to this, and this is where the debate took place. 165,000 constituents in a state school board race with very little dollars contributed. That means that the dialogue in a nonpartisan race of what, you know, of what it means to represent the state on the state school board, what education issues are critical, that conversation in that large of a district of 160, mine's 36,000, I think the Senate's just under 100,000, there aren't even the dollars to have those kinds of conversations. So you start seeing issues like the first name on the ballot having a statistical advantage, or some people preferring a female over a male on a school board. Not necessarily high information that people go into the ballot box to vote on. And so the partisan school board races where you have delegates that represent every voting precinct of a jurisdiction, more so than whether they're Republican or Democrat, provided some way to have an infrastructure where that kind of direct dialogue and communication could have spanning the whole district you'd seek to represent. And so we couldn't get around that. That was the hard part about that nonpartisan election cycle without information that people are making that decision.
The Senate proposal was actually partisan and then put the 2016.
So
you're actually making my argument. So, thank you very much, Speaker. I appreciate that.
So
on the nonpartisan that they couldn't help us get
on that last night, as the clock was running down, they brought this conference report back, and I think it was 11-63 or something like that. So we'll be back, I guess, to address this issue later.
If I could add really quickly, it's because I would say predominantly our body felt very strongly about making it nonpartisan. And some of the arguments, notably the numbers, I get that, but some of the arguments that were made on the floor, things that were said that gave me quite a bit of pause, were things like, well, people want to know what people's philosophies are like before they vote for them as a school board member. And I can't tell you the number of times that I get calls from constituents who want to learn more about their school board member, and they actually ask me, and I invite them, take a look at their website, review what committees they've sat on, have conversations with the school communities that they've interacted with. I'm trying to get people to become more engaged with the process. And I personally believe by keeping the school board races nonpartisan, it really kind of forces those people to do their homework. Now, you know, there's questions to that, but that's what gave me great pause, and I think a number of our colleagues in the House.
So we've got this photo here of the protest, or the rally, I guess, that UEA held in the last week of the session. They filled the rotunda. It was a pretty impressive turnout. Senator DeBacchus, they were asking for 6.25%. They got 4%. Should they be satisfied?
No. We sat together on the Education Committee, and the senator did a terrific job heading up. That's a hard horse to handle. Look, you know, we're so busy patting ourselves on the back. Oh, look at, we gave all this money to education. Isn't that wonderful? You know where we rank after all of this? Do you know what that got us? This, the first tax increase since the Bangor administration, and what are we calling it now? Equalization. We did a tax raise for $75 million. That's what happened. Even with all of that, all the new money going in there, we still rank 50th per person. And we can't even see the bottom. We do not prioritize education in this state. Our commitment is not there. It is not a somewhere where we should put, where we have put our heart. Yes, it's better than the previous years, but we weren't even keeping up with growth. That's issue number one on education. Issue number two, we need to talk about where we are spending the money. The state school board, give me a break. You know what they got pushed through in this session? Listen to this. They hate the Common Core. A lot of people hate the Common Core. Well, they decided we're going to show Washington who's in charge. So they said, take the $30 million the feds give us for Common Core and rip up the check, because we're going to send a message to the Common Core. And that cuts millions of dollars to the school districts, $2.5 million to Salt Lake. It was $16 million to some school districts, because these people want to send an ideological message to Washington about the Common Core. Then they came to the state and said, oops, we need that money put back in there, because we have said, Washington, if you don't send us the money, that those millions, if you don't let us out of the requirements, we're not taking the money. We want waivers.
So they went to the state and said, you know, our school districts need that money for a year to make the transition. And the state did what? It marched right over to Wendover, and as the state school board is gambling with that $30 million on a waiver, the state voted to take other funding money and back up the bluff, which the feds may not give us the money. The state school board, I think that kind of ideology is already bad enough. And if we were to turn that partisan, it's going to be these conventions that pick the state school board. Talk about a catastrophe for education, a catastrophe.
Tonight, he mentioned one thing I wanted to ask you about, and we're going to kind of use this to segue into another topic. But this year, the budget, there was about $750 million in new money. And as Senator Backus and Senator Milner mentioned, you guys passed a $76 million property tax hike. You also passed about a $35 to $40 million gas tax hike. So can I have your Republican card now so I can rip it up? Or? Well, no, what happened? Explain
honestly,
that to us.
But you got to watch because Jim just ran right over top of that and dismissed it out of hand. See, this is what happens. When you put the state budget together, it's like a water balloon. Anywhere you push on or try to find emphasis or priority, something else is going to give somewhere else. It's all, we're talking about all the same money and how we appropriate responsibly. That $75 million equalization in property tax, which you're right, Robert, that is an increase in people's property taxes where we're equalizing them across the state. $25 million is equal to a percentage of the weighted pupil unit, okay? So you can take the 4% that we raised, and you could, by way of this tax, this property tax equalization or increase, another 3%. That is 7% increase from where we were before we started. Now, if you hear, and if policymakers hear, this is abysmal. What you've done is not even move this ball an inch. We still can't see any day late from where we're at. Well, then there are other places. I mean, this is the merry-go-round that appropriators feel that they're on sometimes. Here's a record amount of money. How are we doing right now? Well, terrible. Why? You didn't give enough. Well, here, I mean, and so at some point, this is where I think politics starts to seep in, where we start to become cynical of these messages. If the $500 million of additional money, if we can't watch that and see how it is improving, how we're delivering education to kids, and this is a complete wipeout, I am telling you, those same dollars, there are places within the state budget, whether it's social services, whether it's higher ed that was left short in many people's estimation. There are places that we could put those dollars as well. We're just trying to do as much as we can with the dollars that we have. We gotta be careful that we don't just run over a tax increases. Jim's done and said, this is terrible, it's not even worth, it hasn't done anything. It has to do something. We have to make sure that those dollars are well appropriated.
So let's
I just want to add, I mean, what's really important, first of all, there's a couple, sometimes we use numbers and we use one-time money and ongoing money, and we kind of add them together, and that doesn't really work. I mean, one-time money has to be used for one-time things and ongoing money for ongoing investments, and so there really wasn't $800 million in ongoing money. I mean, I do think you have to separate that out, and it's pretty hard for the public to, when we use those numbers, when we combine those numbers.
Yeah.
But the other side of this, on the education side, is what we do need to focus on in the state is we talk about the dollars a lot, but what I'd really like to talk about is our kids and learning achievement. And I think what we need to step back and say is, where are we, and we compare ourselves to other states. Two decades ago, our kids were in the top 10, Utah was in the top 10 in terms of the states on performance, in things like reading at grade level in fourth grade, math at grade level, in fourth and eighth grade. I mean, we were in the top 10 of the states. Over the past two decades, we have fallen out, and we're kind of in the middle of the pack now. Some of our other peer states that we measure ourselves against when we look at kind of some demographic kinds of things are still up there. We've got to focus on how do we focus on kind of essential learning outcomes, measure our kids' performance, make strategic investments that will allow our kids to be able to excel and return to the top 10. So they'll be competitive with kids from other states, because that's what we want for our kids, that's what we want for our families, and ultimately that's what we want for the state. So sometimes I get a little, I mean, it takes dollars, but let's talk about what we're trying to achieve with those, because I think people would be much more receptive if we were talking about, we want to make strategic investments to help our kids do better.
Right. So we're just going to touch on this one real fast. I wanted to talk about the gas tax a little bit. It's going to be a five cent increase up front, and then it's going to be indexed by 12% of the cost of the gasoline as it passes $2.45 at the wholesale. So it's fairly complicated, but you're going to be paying 5 cents more per gallon up front, and then it'll grow as the price of gasoline grows. So who wants to take a crack at this, just real quickly, and then I want to turn it open for questions after that.
So in 1997, the rack price, or the price before you put the federal and state tax on a gallon of gas, was $1.09. And you would pay after that 24.5 cents of state tax. Today, the rack price is much higher. We have put a base that the rack price would be $2.45 before you would see that increase in there, other than the 5 cents. But you need to know, and commuters need to know, that motor fuel tax, if you adjust for inflation, you are still paying less today than in 1997 for a gallon of gas by way of state tax. Today, after that increase in that new formula than you were paying back in 97 when it was raised. Why is that important? One of the fastest regions growth-wise in the country. We have more miles to maintain, more expansion in front of us, and that motor fuel tax, because it was only 24.5 cents of a unit tax, shrunk by way of inflation and cars driving further on a gallon of gas than ever before. So that motor fuel tax, which used to be our bread and butter for paying for roads, it stopped doing that job a long time ago. And the result has been that we've gone into debt, more bonds have been put in place to pay for projects, and we've taken from the general fund that could have been used for higher education / public education.
That's right.
We have taken those dollars because the motor fuel tax stopped doing its job. Now that it'll be this percentage, it will grow, and it has a growth formula where now we don't have to see the strain on other areas of the budget. So it's a big, heavy lift, and there are people that are going to say there was a tax increase involved there. You are paying less for your gallon of gas and by way of state tax today after this change and this formula change than you were paying in 1997, and I think that it took a big effort for everyone to get involved to get that big change in place. It'll be a big deal.
Okay. Anybody else want to chime in?
No, it was great. I mean, Greg spearheaded that. It was a tax increase, but our roads are falling apart, and it's a user tax. Right now, we're stealing money out of education indirectly here, but it comes out of education and the other places to build our roads. This says you use the roads, you pay.
And I guess the one thing I would add to it is when we reap these savings that we're able to restore back to the general fund, let's apply it to those priority areas. Let's get it back to education. Let's look at funding teacher preparation days and all those different things that people have been asking for the past few years. A lot of times what ends up happening is we find these savings, we reap these savings, and then they don't go to the priorities that our constituents ask us to spend it on.
Okay. I think we're going to take some questions from the audience now. If anybody has a question, just raise your hand, or if nobody has a question, I'm sure
no
I can come
questions.
Up with something else. All right. Nobody has a question. So, well, let's talk about this then. One of the things.
Just out of here.
Professor Chambliss here has a question.
Eric Wall. Last day of January, we had thousands of Utahns, concerned citizens, standing on the steps of the Utah State Capitol. The speaker was there, who said he could see Draper. And yet, what was the outcome? 17 bills dealing with air quality for the legislature.
You know, I have not looked at which bills went, but I will tell you, not enough. And I will tell you that that issue is not one that's going to fix itself. As we talk about all these additional automobiles on the road, we know that a majority of this air quality, or its lack of air quality, comes from tailpipes. And there has got to be some good legislation passed. I have been one to say, look, the way you get things, perfect can't be the enemy of good. The way we get some of these big heavy lifts in terms of air quality done is you can't pit the environment and being good stewards of the environment against the economy or against industry. We've got to find smart ways where everyone's working on this together. One of the big aspirational things that I'd like to continue to talk about in this interim is we have natural gas, we have an alternative fuel and a clean fuel and an incredible reserve of that in this state of Utah. We talk about energy independence. Utah independence could be realized if we could see, particularly the thousands and thousands of government fleet vehicles that use diesel now that we could convert to clean fuel. That is something that I think would, there's Uinta Basin wells and Uinta Basin jobs, and there is a way to find clean fuel vehicles driving our roads. Governor Huntsman doesn't get enough credit for the amount of service or CNG stations that he had. He partnered with Questar or encouraged Questar to put along I-15 along the state, and per capita, we have some of the highest usage of natural gas vehicles by the public because there's an infrastructure, a basic infrastructure in place. It needs to improve. But things like that, I think, are areas that we've got to do a better job of concentrating.
Representative Chavez-Houck has her cheat sheet out here with all the tracking.
So she has a cheat sheet.
Yeah, so we had a number of bills. I would say it was mixed results. We've got a number of bills that were passed. The transportation bill that provides the gas tax also provides funding to be utilized for transit. And also there were some pieces of legislation related to strengthening our ability to implement standards, air quality standards that are different than the EPA, and the operative word is different. That's something that our colleague Representative Edwards has been championing for the last 2 to 3 years, and we got that bill through. Representative Arendt ran some legislation related to vehicles that tweak their emissions so that they blow out black smoke intentionally. And now people who do that can be penalized for doing that. They'll not be able to re-register their vehicles if they do that. So there were some that were good. We didn't get as far as we would have liked with a number of other bills. Representative Steve Handy has been trying to run legislation to retrofit school buses and replace school buses, and that was a heavy financial lift. That was a $20 million price tag. Just did not get there. But he has been working on that for the last couple of years. But you know, not as deep as we did last year in terms of the number of bills or the amount of appropriations, but things that we have cared about, continued research for DAQ, research funding for DAQ, that's back in the docket. So we've got that there. Clean air retrofit grants that can be utilized by agencies and businesses to retrofit both the vehicles and equipment like lawnmowers. That we were able to get some additional funding for. Again, not what our top request was and not what the governor had requested, but it's there and it will continue to move the ball forward. But still a lot of work to do. It was a challenge because we had clean air. I mean, that's right. Just notable, unfortunately, when the weather is nice and we don't have bad inversions as present and in our face, so to speak, people aren't as vocal.
So hope for bad air next January, I guess, if you want to see changes on this. We got probably time for one more question up here.
So I read in the Tribune yesterday that lawmakers have okayed spending over $12 million to fight the federal government to take over public lands. How do you justify spending that kind of money for?
Let's send this one to Senator DeBacchus, and I'm going to move a little bit because he's going to go off here.
Get ready. Is there a splash card?
Look, we have an inbred group that loves the tension on public lands between the state and the federal government. And they suck off the public tit to the tune of $12 million precious dollars just this year. They love it. It creates a wonderful controversy. It pits one Utahn against another Utahn. They just love to be able to say our education is bad because of all this public land. You know what? I had what I thought was a reasonable bill. It said, you know what? Let's take $2 or $3 million. Let's push this to the United States Supreme Court right now. Let's go under original jurisdiction and say, you nine justices, will you tell us for once and for all, who does this $32 million belong to forever? and let's be over with it. You know what? If they decide that the feds need to turn the deed over to the state of Utah, I will hate it, but I can live with it. And if they say, you know what, Utah, you're never getting that land, tough. Then we get back to the table, we roll up our sleeves, and we know who the alpha dog is, because we're at this table and we've been there for two generations arguing about the price of the house, and both the dogs think they own the house. We need that Supreme Court to tell us for once and for all, who is that 32 million acres? That's what my bill would have done, but there's too many people in state government and out of state government that love spending their share of the 12 million, and they don't want this thing settled for once and for all. They want this to be around as an issue when your children and great-grandchildren are up in the legislature, and that's a pity. We ought to figure this out for once and for all, and then we ought to get on with our lives as Utahns.
Do one of our Republican members want to address that, or...
That's all I do is, you know, just answer to Jim. And he said, we have a radio show, you know.
Good, get a plug
yeah,
in.
Yeah, you get both sides of the aisle. KCBW, very good show. Here's the issue. If anyone's aware of the school institutional trust lands where our community councils get together and there are resources provided to every single school, and the parents and the teachers and the administrators of that school look for additional needs that that school has, they use CITLA dollars. If you saw a map of Utah, you would see it's just dotted across the state of land that has been able to be invested and revenue derived from that has been a huge resource to these schools. Now, I grew up in back east in Pennsylvania, and I will tell you that most states in this country, when we talk about how Utah compares in public ed spending to other states, property tax is the engine for education funding in this country. It is the engine. I want you to look at a state where you have more children or students per taxpayer, and then 65% of that land that is unavailable. It doesn't mean you're going to pave this entire state. It doesn't mean you're going to put oil rigs across the whole state. But just like CITLA, I don't know that anyone in the education community or in the state would criticize the work of CITLA. Maybe they do. But I will tell you that there are incredible opportunities to be good stewards of this land here in the state of Utah, as well as see those revenues. I mean, go up to Wyoming. They are able to fund their schools because they have access to their lands. Severance tax. There's all kinds of opportunities that you have. Utah, if we want to, I mean, it's one of the ways we can be serious about and address the funding gap we see in the state of Utah is to have the ability to manage those lands, Robert, but do it responsibly.
Robert, if I just add really quickly, I think we need to tax smart and not tax more property. I think that if we were to match our severance tax rates with those of our neighboring states, we wouldn't have to expand the amount of land that we're taxing, but just be smarter about the way we do it.
One last question up here.
Two items I'd like to address. One is on the air pollution. Why won't the media and the representatives and whoever else that's in on this deal, the guys up at the university and all, cite the real pollution problem, which is Ira Renner's magnesium plant out there. All you got to do is watch when the wind is blowing from the northwest or from the south. From the south, you don't have that coming in, the plume coming in. When it comes out of the north, it comes in. The next one is how did all of you, and especially you, Senator Tabakas, ever get so far away from the Constitution itself and, on the land issue, the Northwest Ordinance? Thank you.
There is one bill that I don't think we mentioned on the air quality, and I believe it's Senator Okerlund was sponsoring a bill that would give a tax incentive for refinery equipment to purchase, and I don't know if this is on topic of what you were discussing, but it's a tax credit to try to get these the refineries up here to retrofit or to upgrade their for Tier 3 gasoline, which is one of the things that the scientists at the university and elsewhere have said would make a huge difference.
Just what we need. We need to take Utah taxpayers' money and give it to Soros so they can do what they should be doing. There was another bill, Senator Escamilla's bill, which failed. And let me tell you what that would have done. We have a statute of limitations against convicted corporate polluters here of 1 year, 1 year from the date of the infraction. And it would have put that out to 5 years. Why? Because we so disfund the investigators
for the Department of Air Quality that they only get around every 4 years. So they're getting, do you see what the problem mathematically is with this? They only get around every 4 years, but the statute of limitations is 1 year. And then when they do get around, guess what? Our state fines haven't gone up in 38 years. This bill would have put our fines in the same as the federal government, but I'm telling you, those corporate interests, those corporate polluters were there. So no statute of limitations change, it's still 1 year, and our fines now are gonna be what they were in real dollar terms 39 years ago. That's one of the problems we have.
Okay, do we have... Okay. Sorry.
I wanted to thank both bodies for the great work they did around criminal justice reform this session and the great steps we've taken forward in that arena, but also wondering what your thoughts are about the prison relocation question and the connection that has with maximizing our investment in criminal justice reform.
Great question. I just heard the speaker like getting all excited. He's gearing up for an answer on this
one. Any other year, the work that Representative Hutchings has done and that those lawmakers have done for justice reform, it would have dominated our headlines. And it's one of the sad parts is that such incredible reform. The Pew Foundation came in. When the talk of relocating this prison occurred, there was this opportunity. You know that for some reason, the state of Utah, its increase in beds and growth in prison population outpaces the whole country. And that actually adds to the cost of what this prison, if you were going to relocate it, would look like and what large of an expansion it would be. Well, the Pew Foundation came in and they met the Department of Corrections, which wasn't defensive or saying they didn't want to hear what good ideas or best practices were out there. They received them with open arms. We saw within criminal justice system, absolute and eager participation. And then when they came up with these reforms, some of them was to say, we're not gonna criminalize drug offenders because, you know, they're finding themselves outside of the law, maybe because they're sick or addicted, and then you put them in a criminal population where of people that are really criminals, and when they come out, well, this is where we see the recidivism, where people are coming right back in because it was almost a training ground. What kind of treatment can be given people that are truly sick, and how can we be better at assessing that at the time of sentencing? That has happened, but the counties looked at that and said, wait, you guys just want to take a felony and move it down to a misdemeanor and then fill all of our county jails with these same people. Well, that's not reform, and they came out just saber-rattling against this reform. But it took education, Representative Hutchings and so many of the advocates here to walk our counties, our prosecutors, our county sheriffs through this process to show this isn't a way to fill the jails, but we're gonna do this assessment, we're gonna do it right. And then it was up to the state to fully fund this, and we did that. We committed to make sure that we had the funds available to make sure this reform happened. This, again, is one of these big moments in our state's history in terms of changing that trajectory for people's lives, as well as the growth of prison population. We're gonna see that change now. But it's one of those things that gets caught into the discussions of anti-discrimination, transportation, education.
There were so many big issues. Just to add to that, I mean, I had the opportunity to sit down with a number of judges prior to the session, and there was a lot of conversation about the discussion that had been going on about really looking at this reform measures. And, you know, they were saying 80% of what they see of the criminals really begins with drugs. And that if we were able to kind of take a different fork in the road and get them to treatment and get them the kind of support and help that they need, we could make a difference not only in the quality of their lives, but also our entire system here. And so I do think that was a really big, big effort, and it did kind of go underneath the radar screen in some ways because we had so many issues. But I think it's really important to the future of the state and families of the state.
And imperative to that, just to dovetail, is the funding for substance abuse and other health concerns. And our friends in the judiciary and others that work with those individuals were very clear that it needed to be something, if not Healthy Utah, something as rigorous, because these folks have coexisting health problems that can so readily be dealt with. Both our folks that work with the county correctional systems and the state correctional systems felt very strongly that it's going to be a wobbly stool if we don't have something there very ardently there for the health care, and they were advocating on behalf of Healthy Utah in
that cases. But Senator Baucus...
Terrific. It was a great moment for the legislature, I think, passing this. I think Representative Hutchings did a terrific job. Of course, we would have had $4 million more had we passed Healthy Utah, but I'm not bringing that up because it's such a shining, amazing... good moment, and I think it's one of our one where we came together, and I'm proud of us.
Well, and it's a big departure from the last 5 years, where I saw a statistic before the session that we had created 75 new felonies and taken 3 off the books in the years leading up to this, and so now we're seeing, as Speaker Hughes mentioned, a reduction in some of these drug crimes and a focus on reducing recidivism and getting rehabilitation. So. Well, with that, I think we would give a round of applause to our panelists here tonight. Thank you all for joining us, and thank you for tuning in and for continuing to read the Tribune. I appreciate it. Thank you.